What a beautiful song to enter into our project here. Outside Now, it's about getting out of the box. And our guest here is Roxana Flores Lorenzar, presently living in Berlin. And she was recently interviewed in a major Mexican music magazine. What's it called? Nexos? Roxy?
Well, it's a magazine. They have all topics. It's an important publication.
Yeah, it's called Nexos, N-E-X-O-S?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in this, they, because Roxy visited Mexico City last March, she reconnected with a lot of her fellow composers and studio people, engineers and artists, and they noticed that she was alive and active and creative. They all started to want to work with her, a few of them anyways. And the magazine heard about this. Probably Roxy's friend Mateo mentioned what Roxy was doing, that he was going to work with Roxy. So the magazine said, oh, I don't know if the guy that David got interviewed you knew about you before. Did he? Did he know you in the 80s and 90s? Is he that old?
Yes, he's that old. He's even older, I think.
Right. So he said, oh, Roxy's available. He probably didn't know what had happened to you. So he interviews you, and it's a good interview to cover what happens in your first 25 years of your life in Mexico City, in the electronic composing community and the nightclub world, the synthesizer world. Let's see, you born in 68, so 26 years, because you go to Berlin in 1994. So the interview covers the unique experience that Roxy had as a, I call her a Mexican princess, part of the oligarchy of Mexico, and had a privileged experience but took full advantage as a semi-autistic kid who ignored her teachers and everybody and just was creative on her own terms and ended up meeting all the great artists, composers, and cultural elite of Mexico, hung out with them since she was 11 years old, including the famous author of 100 Years of Solitude, Gabriel Marquez something.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Yeah, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I mean, Bob Dylan carried that novel around with him in his 1974 world tour, telling everybody to read 100 Years of Solitude. So Roxy is a younger person, even like around that time. No, not the 70s, but in the 80s and 90s, visiting a famous journalist, a neighbor of hers. And there was Gabriel Garcia talking to the journalist, their old buddies. And Roxy, as a young teenager, would hear them talking and hang out with it. Had no idea who he was till he died, you know, a couple of years ago. So, and Roxy played in the background, in the backyard of Frida Kahlo, the famous artist, and movies have been made, and everybody else. Even, what's the name of the peasant leader, Riquito Burger or something?
Rigoberta Menchú. Well, they were all neighbors in Coyoacán. And like you said, I met Juan Maria El Ponte, and he was like the Google for...
The Google for information.
Yeah, for Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Like when he wanted to know anything about economy or politics, he would go and ask him.
Because he had 30,000 books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He, you know, the old POBs.
POB, print-oriented bastards, right.
But memorized everything because there was no Google. So
right.
People.
Now, just what was the name of the peasant activist? You said her name, but too fast. What's her name?
Rigoberta Menchú.
Oh, okay, Rigoberta Menchú.
Prize for peace. And
you met her. You also met the great artist Remedios Varo and Wyndham Lewis associate Leonora Carrington.
No, Remedios Varo was already dead.
I know, but you met Leonora Carrington, but not Remedios.
Her husband.
Oh, you met Remedios' husband?
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat. So, pretty privileged in Mexican culture to have been part of all that education. But it started with Roxy's grandfather. He was a pretty interesting character. And then it ended up here in Ayandom.
Yes, there is famous writer in our hood in Coyoacán, Francisco Sosa. He was like the chronist of, you say chronist?
Chronist, what's that mean?
He wrote the chronicles of the city and Coyoacán.
Like a civic historian.
Yeah, Francisco Sosa, he wrote a biography of my great-great-grandfather.
Oh, yeah?
The Reinser. So that was in Coyoacán in 1913.
What is this word Coyoacán that you're saying? What's that, a suburb?
Well, it was a town outside Tenochtitlan, the Aztec city.
Yeah.
When the Spaniards came, they destroyed everything. They had to burn every single building in the Aztec city because the Aztecs will not give up. So they were burning every single building, every single street. Everything was destroyed completely to the ground.
Yeah.
Everything. So there was a big lake. The city was actually like Venice inside the lake.
Yeah.
And after the big war, they had to build first outside the Aztec city.
Right.
They went to this area called Coyoacán because everything else in the Aztec city was burned down.
Right.
And destroyed. So the first Spanish buildings in Mexico were made in that area, were built in that area.
And how do you spell it? Say the letters.
Coyoacán.
Coyoacán. Something like that.
It means something like the place of the coyotes.
Right. So the coyotes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was the rebuilding of the Aztec Venice, starting over again. And that's the big war is in the 1700s, 1800s. When's the big war?
During the conquest.
That's 1600s, 1500s.
1521 in August was the last battle.
Did you just Google that?
No.
You know it. Okay.
It's not 12. Yeah.
Okay, now that's at the time of Leonardo da Vinci and Francis I over there in France, you know, 1521. So
yeah.
that's another topic.
Yeah, that's the time of Charles V, the
yes.
main enemy of Charles I.
Of Francis I, the main enemy of France versus Charles V. Yeah, he's the Spanish, Austrian, Hungarian Empire. Okay, or emperor. So, in this interview, it does pretty good about describing your precocious early years, meeting the Gurdjieffian group that studied electronic composing, and then going to Washington, then coming back, and then getting very involved with the studio. And what's his name? Rusek? R-U-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S- you form some bands, and that's sort of known, and the guy asks you about that, and you give the details, the hard work of lugging your equipment around to clubs and all that. But you stood out as a woman. Not many women were doing that, especially on the synthesizer. But then you gave it all up, and you went to Berlin, and you became a scholar at first, but still pursuing your electronic composing. So that's what we were going to start off at, Berlin, because he ends in 1994. So I'm going to take a copy of Marsh McLuhan's Understanding Media, and it's the paperback version called A Mentor Book, the 27th printing, and I'm going to go to page 286, and this is how we're going to start. This is a section on television. So McLuhan is saying, clothing and styling. Now, Roxy also is a clothes, did a lot in Berlin about that. Clothing and styling in the past decade. So he's writing this in the early 60s, so about the 50s. Clothing and styling in the 50s have gone so tactile and sculptural that they present a sort of exaggerated evidence of the new qualities of the TV mosaic. The TV extension of our nerves in hirsute, which means hairy, in hairy hirsute pattern, possesses the power to evoke a flood of related imagery in clothing, hairdo, walk, and gesture. and we could add music, rock and roll came in. All this adds up to the compressional implosion, the return to non-specialized forms of clothes and spaces, the seeking of multi-uses for rooms and things and objects. In a single word, this compressional implosion revolves around the word the iconic, TV, the iconoscope. So then McLuhan says, in music and poetry and painting, the tactile implosion means the insistence on qualities that are close to casual speech. So speech is tactile. So music, poetry, and painting start trying to acquire the qualities of casual speech. Then McLuhan says, thus Schoenberg and Stravinsky and Karl Orff and Bartok, far from being advanced seekers of esoteric effects, seem now to have brought music very close to the condition of ordinary human speech. It is this colloquial rhythm that once seemed so unmelodious about their work. Anyone who listens to the medieval works of Perotinus or Dufay will find them very close to Stravinsky and Bartok. The great explosion of the Renaissance that split musical instruments off from song and speech and gave them specialist functions is now being played backward in our age of electronic implosion. Then that's the music part. Then just to show you where he goes with it, one of the most vivid examples of the tactile quality of the TV image occurs in medical experience. In closed-circuit instruction in surgery, medical students from the first reported a strange effect, that they seemed not to be watching an operation when they were viewing it on TV, but performing it. They felt that they were holding the scalpel. Thus, the TV image, in fostering a passion for depth involvement in every aspect of experience, creates an obsession with bodily welfare, you know, body lifting, body, what do you call it, Ebonics, no, what is it, what's that bouncing stuff people did in the 80s, the exercise, not Ebonics, but some kind of stuff led by Jane Fonda.
Jack Lorraine.
Aerobics. Aerobics.
Aerobics, that's what it was. Yeah, aerobics. And so that's where he's saying the suddens, the TV image in fostering a passion for depth involvement in every aspect of experience creates an obsession with bodily welfare. Yeah, Jack Lane is part of that fad, and aerobics. So the obsession with polishing up the chemical body. The sudden emergence of the TV medico and the hospital ward is a program to rival the Western. It's perfectly natural. That's those TV shows, Dr. Kildare, Dr. Casey, these medical shows that came in the early 60s on TV, medical sitcoms. It would be possible to list a dozen untried kinds of programs that would prove immediately popular for the same reasons. Tom Dooley and his epic of Medicare for the backward society was a natural outgrowth of the first TV decade. Okay, so he says, now that we have considered the subliminal force of the TV image in a redundant scattering of samples, blah, blah, blah. So back to this. Schoenberg and Stravinsky and Karl Orff and Bartok, far from being advanced seekers of esoteric effects, seem now to have brought music very close to the condition of ordinary human speech. So my question, Roxy, is you go to Berlin, you are going to have the opportunity of meeting Stockhausen and other people like Pierre Schaeffer. What does this quote make you think of in your thinking about music back then when you go to Berlin? Are you aware of these modern 20th century composers trying to approximate the world of human speech? Is that an idea in your mind?
Yes, but never like this. Like, this is Marshall McLuhan?
Yes. This is Understanding Media, page 286 of the paperback version, 1964. You're not even born when he wrote this. Well, do you agree with it?
Yes, because I was telling you yesterday, I woke up thinking about how everything is about communication.
Yes.
And organisms, as they become more complex, they expand also in the area in which they can communicate. And everything seems to be like the hidden ground of evolution seems to be this communication. And there is these animals that have their little shells, and the animal is not only the organism, but the animal and the shell. So if you want to represent humans, I think the only way to do it is with your system of the six bodies.
Yeah.
Because it's not only your physical body, like these little animals. In order to see what humans are, they should represent humans and all of their creations. And I suppose this is what the Temple of Man was all about in Luxor. And why they took this pattern to make it in the Louvre and made it like the archive of the best, the highest human creations of all times.
Right.
Up to the particle accelerator that they have under the inverted pyramid. And
so,
yeah, behind the technologies, the thing that is motivating this evolution is language, or the need to communicate, and then we develop all these technologies not only to broadcast but to record the message and communicate even with people from different time periods. There is no time, but it's like this. The guy was talking about Homer. I mean, it's amazing that we can read what he wrote and now.
Yeah. You know, as you say this, I think about you don't exist unless you have somebody else responding to you. So McLuhan said this. He was once asked, will there ever be silence? So he said, well, objects are unobservable. So silence itself is unobservable. Only relationships among objects are observable. So communication is the given fact of existence. When you communicate, you exist because someone else responds to you.
We develop all these different types of codes to program ourselves and the environment, and music is one of these codes.
That would be the adjustment. As you interact with your environment as an organism, and Thompson writes about this, and he has a little film that Lynn Margulis made. He talks about showing the spirochete on the cell and how it begins to communicate with the environment and feed off it. So tactility is defined as the interplay of senses, not a sense. It's not an object. It's the interplay. The way I just define language is determining how you are, whether you exist or not, that's a tactile impulse. Language is tactility, the communication. So when the Macy conferences came in the late 40s with Margaret Mead and Norbert Wiener and those people, they came up with this phrase, information theory. They said everything was reduced to information. I'm not an expert on how they define it, but that sounds like what your idea is, that everything is communication, and communication establishes being. You have to bounce off something.
Yes, and this is the thing for me with music, like you were asking me if I see...
Music, that's speech.
Language.
Yeah.
it's like some way of code on programming that we use all these different types of languages.
Which include technologies.
Yeah, and there is something about the electronic environment that really, really turned me on. Like
when you were 11.
Yeah, like I remember exactly the feeling I had when I pressed it was like a sort of a keyboard that was controlling this big analog synthesizer they had in the School of Music.
Yeah.
The sound that came out, I was expecting something like an organ, but it was something like cosmic, galactic, amazing.
Right.
I just felt like really like expanding. Like it was such a feeling that I said I want to do this. I need to understand this machine. It's like I really wanted to interface with.
You wanted to get massaged by it.
Yes. So,
and you did that. You followed that.
In that moment, I was so amazed, so turned on by this synthesizer that's what I wanted to do all my life.
That was your first sexual experience.
To have that massage, that feeling.
Yeah, that was your first sexual experience.
Well, it's tactility.
Yeah, it's tactility. So, so when you get to Berlin, do you immediately register for university book courses?
Yes, because I went to French school. They recognized the French baccalaureate, so I had no problem in getting in the university. And in Mexico, in this center that was made by Antonio Rusek, the Independent Center of Investigations of Music and Multimedia, it was called.
Multimedia,
everybody,
you had that phrase.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, everybody that came from other countries will contact Rusek at COM, and we had the chance to meet a lot of important electronic music composers that went to Mexico. So I had the chance to meet François Bell. He was the director of the group de Recherche Musicale.
In Paris?
There were two main centers of electronic music in Paris. One was the one made by Pierre Schaeffer, the IRCAM.
Yeah.
And the other was the GRM, the Group de Recherche Musicale. And François Bell was the director of that. And he was a super cool guy, super friendly. And when I came to Berlin, like the first weekend, there was a concert by him. So I went to see him, and I said, well, now I want to study here, and maybe I'll go also to Paris. And he was very, very, very nice. He told the director of the electronic music studio in the Technische Universität in Berlin, the technical university.
Yeah.
That I was a great composer.
Wow.
He was really, like, very nice. Like,
yeah.
For him, I mean, he just did it to help me.
Yes, like. Yeah.
And
that's wonderful.
The professor then said, oh, well, you have to enroll to the university and then you can work in the studio. And I did.
And that you were there. That's your first week there.
Well, when I saw François Bell, yeah.
Yeah, you went to the concert, met him. He talked to the other guy, and you were in the school a few days later.
No. Then I had to enroll in the university and all. But it's not the same when you're introduced. But this very important person.
Yeah. No, that's good. The teacher's going to notice you right away. So you had to take a full program, so you had to take book courses, right?
Yes, in Germany you have to study two or three careers at the same time. You choose your main career and then another besides.
Yeah, they call it major and minor in North America. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was your minor?
I was into communications and electrotechnic.
Wow.
But then I changed the electrotechnic to art and music, musicology, I don't know how you say it. musicology?
Yeah, musicology.
Because, yeah, mathematics and electricity and all that, I really liked it, but it was at a level like to become an engineer. So.
Right. So you went to the history of art and musicology.
Yeah.
So what's interesting is that you were at an institute as a kid that had the phrase multimedia in it. So you were on your way to McLuhan, but you never heard about McLuhan in those years. Or did you say you did in high school, but it just seemed to be talked about advertising or something?
No. In the university, we had like a radio seminar.
Yeah.
And I remember like the first time I consciously heard that name, they gave me a lot of photocopies. And, they said something like, he wrote a lot about advertisement and TV.
Right.
And that's it. That's how they will summarize the work of Marshall McLuhan. And, of course, you read it like in a very superficial way.
Right.
And everybody knows the phrase, the medium is the message, and that's it. Like, oh, I know what he's about. You know, you think you know.
Right, and you also weren't watching TV, so it wasn't a significant topic to you.
No, we had this radio in the university where we could do things, and I really liked that.
So you were a DJ. You programmed the radio? You had a slot?
We did different things in the studio, like we will program sound effects or
right.
record things, edit. Yeah, so I really liked the radio.
Yeah.
But I was never into TV.
Right. So that first year you start studying philosophy.
Well, I started in the French school in high school. I was in the section of philosophy and literature.
Yeah.
Literature. Yeah. So I already had the basics from the French education.
Right. Okay, so when you get to this technical university, are you a lefty? Do you have a political affiliation, and that leads you to study Marx?
Well, I will, because I wanted to become a nun, I always was out of, like Ion says, a communist.
Yeah.
But like in a very idealistic way.
Yeah.
And when I was in the French school, we read some of the German philosophers, but sometimes to just explain one word, because, you know, Germans can put words together and then that becomes another concept. To explain some of these words, some of these concepts, we had like pages and pages, and I was like, wow, I want to read these people in German. Like, but yeah, it's very hard to translate.
Yeah. So you had to learn German.
Yes. But then I thought I was going to stay here for 2 or 3 years, but then I stayed until now. I really like Berlin.
Okay, so you start reading Marx. Were you going to say that because he was the reference point for the other philosophers? Like,
well, because he did these metanoias of society and economics. And it's really, you know, many people talk about some authors just like without really knowing what they really wrote.
Yeah.
And in the art world, it's like the right thing to be is like to be left or socialist. Like in Mexico, there is this tradition of social, politically engagement. And for example, in Coyoacán, there was Frida Kahlo, who was a communist. And she and her husband even were hosts for Trotsky.
Right.
So you grew up with these ideas that, like, that's the right way to...
Right.
...to handle the world, but then... It is very contradictory that the husband of Frida Kahlo worked for the Rockefellers.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing with many, many people that say that they are engaged in socialism. I mean, they talk about Marx, and like the Beatles song say, you say you want a revolution, but it's like they don't really, they haven't even read Marx or... They don't even understand economics and politics, like really, really.
But they, like, but they want to have a revolution.
Yes, just they just say it because it's like the thing to say. And of course, in Mexico, there was this big students movement in the 60s.
Yeah.
And a lot of people still had somebody. Or themselves were involved into that, and they all had these ideals of the Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. You know, the Cuba was for many artists like a role model for art education. Like they really have still very good art schools, and the school in general is very good.
In Cuba.
In Latin America, yeah.
Oh, Latin America, all over.
Yeah. And so I really wanted to know what was that about, really,
yeah.
For... And it's very important to get these notions of Karl Marx, I think, to understand... The second thing that is motivating human creation, which is economy, finances, and
that's the second everything. Level of communication.
Yes, everything like Frank Zappa said, we're all here for the money.
Yeah, we're only here for the money. So how many professors or courses, is there any famous professors you took when you did the Marxist studies?
Well, yes, I suppose, but there is a system here. You can, if you're enrolled in one university, you can take seminars in all the universities in Berlin.
Yeah.
And in the Humboldt University, they have like very prestigious professors for history and they used to be the DDR, the communists.
Yeah.
So they have very good professors for art, history in general. And I did took some seminars and they, yeah, the professors were sort of well known, but now I cannot tell you their names.
Right, but you did this for several years.
Yeah.
Taking courses. So did Pierre Schaeffer come to Berlin and teach a course?
Well, the study, the electronic music studio in the university, it was like the equivalent of the Rusek studio in Mexico City. Like, everybody who comes will come then there.
Right.
And give some class or seminar or... to some concert. And they have an amazing, I think it's the most complete library of electronic music. They really have everything that is going on in the...
So you start using that in 94, 95 and never stopped going there and listening to stuff.
Yes. It's like if you want to... To know what's going on, is they have auditions every Thursday, and they are always organizing things there.
Right. So you attended many concerts for 2004, 2014, about 20 years. You started to fade off around 2014 or so, right?
Yes, because it's a very closed environment.
It's almost like a monastery.
Yes, and it's like you start. It's fun for yourself, but then it's like, what's the point of this? Like, am I doing this just for my own enjoyment, or what?
And a few friends who will just come and be the audience for each other.
Yes, because in Mexico, even for contemporary experimental music, there is so many people that even in the concerts, in the festivals for contemporary music, you have a bigger audience.
Mm.
But here in Berlin, there were usually like 5 persons, and
wow,
two were your friends.
Yeah. And yet you were used to big, which you started doing when you were a teenager, these concerts in Mexico City, and there were good-sized audiences. That's what you're used to.
Yes, so...
Because what? There are like 20 million people in Mexico City? 30 million?
Well, the thing is, in Mexico City, the region around Mexico City, there is a place that is not Mexico City that has already 5. And it's all this area around Mexico City is like maybe... I mean, you don't see a real division between the city and the region around.
Yeah.
So actually, it will be like a mass of 30 million, maybe?
Yeah, 30 million people. And they can all get the TV. It's all within the broadcast range.
Yes, anywhere you go, any street food truck has a radio or a TV everywhere.
Right.
We're flooded with radio and TVs everywhere.
Okay, so back to Berlin. What year was it when Stockhausen came? How many years had you done in your school when he came to teach?
Well, he came several times, but I'm very bad for years. Like,
right.
I don't remember the exact time. Maybe it was like 98.
Right. You've been going to school for a few years before he showed up.
Yeah. He had made an opera, and it was going to be presented here, and the professor said, okay, he's going to come, he's going to give a talk. He had a lot of mystical ideas.
Right. Like Rasek in Mexico City.
Well, he had his
own
ideas of Christianity.
Yeah.
And he was like very serious into his ideas of music and mysticism, and he wrote several books about that. And he said, please don't talk to him, don't bother him, don't get near to him. Like,
what? He said, I will talk, but you can't talk back to me.
No, the professor, the director.
The professor said, keep your distance, don't talk to him.
Yes, like... Don't come close to him. Don't bother him.
Can you talk? You can ask questions after his lecture, though.
Yes, but everybody was like really shy.
Right.
He had this type of very intense look, like Picasso.
Yeah.
You know, like they're looking everything like with such an intensity.
Right.
Like, but all the time.
He didn't blink. Yeah. He didn't blink.
Yeah, like this.
And would he look? He look around the classroom intently at different parts.
Yes, he will talk about some of the pieces, and he will go like, wow, and here, yes, and there, he will just be so into his monologue. I really like him. Like I love people that are so passionate, so into whatever they're doing.
And you're saying he was talking, but then sometimes he started whispering.
Well, when he was talking about his music, he will do the.
He'd mime it.
Yeah.
So did you ask a question? Were you shy?
Well, he was like my biggest idol ever.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like that he was into technologies and he still was such a mystic.
Yeah.
So I could identify with that.
Right.
Because many people tell you all electronic music is inhuman and cold and artificial and machinic or whatever. That's the way that the article starts.
On you.
Yeah. And I don't think so, because technology for me is like the most human thing.
Yeah.
But
well, you had that first pleasurable experience. That gets you off on the right footing when you first touched it.
Yeah,
the keyboard.
So I just went to him and told him I really admire his music.
So you did talk to him?
Yes.
Right after, in front of the professor, or
yes.
Privately?
No, in front of everybody.
You broke the rule.
Yes, I was like a fan, like.
Yeah, you had the right to talk to him.
Like, I really love your music. And he looked at me like, did you make electronic music? And I'm like, yes, I'm from Mexico. And he was like completely transformed when he heard Mexico. Like, oh, yes, I was in Mexico and I played for 13 hours. And I know Antonio Rusek was in that concert. And I said, yes, I used to work with this guy. He was in a concert with you. And, yeah, he told me he took some mushrooms and he could then listen for 13 hours. And when the concert finished, he was like, that's it.
He wanted more.
Yes, and he was like, oh, yes, give me your name. Do you want to come to the concert? And I was like, of course. And so in the concert, I was sitting beside him in the sweet spot.
In the sweet spot, did you say?
Yeah, that's the best.
Right. The best position. And he was in the audience. He didn't play.
No, he was.
Yeah,
there.
So you sat with him. And he was talking about in Mexico, he sat and listened to Rusek for 13 hours. Is that what he meant? Or
No, Rusek listened to him.
Oh,
13 hours.
And Rusek was on mushroom.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And Stravinsky, did he have an orchestra, or was it just by himself when he played in Mexico?
In Stockhausen, there was an orchestra and opera singers and electronics.
Was he conducting them?
No, he was giving some directions because the thing was going to be presented without him, but he came to the
city.
Not to the Eröffnung, how do you say, like the first.
Rehearsal.
The first concert.
Oh, okay. And they didn't expect him there. And so then he.
No, they did expect it to him, but he invited me to be there.
No, that's in Berlin. We're talking about Mexico. Did you see the concert that Rusek took the mushrooms for?
No, that was in the 70s, I think.
Yeah, before you knew them. So
yeah.
So you're just saying because you knew the names and about that concert, he liked you, Stockhausen liked you, so he takes you to the performance.
Well, that he remembered Mexico, and he remembered that concert, and he remembered Antonio Rusek, like you're part of those. That
people, yeah. And you knew about the legend of the concert, so you were able to indicate you knew of it.
Yeah, like, he really liked that. He said there were some people that could listen for so long.
Yeah.
Like, they were there for 13 hours.
Right. And he liked that.
I don't know what he did, but, yeah.
Okay, so now he likes you, so he takes you to the concert, and you get to sit beside him.
Yes, and he... he would just talk about his ideas.
He was telling you his ideas.
Yeah, the opera was like about each person was three persons or three entities.
Yeah.
So he had this idea already of that we are not one.
Right.
But because he's a Christian, I suppose he thinks on the Trinity.
Right.
And it was like an opera singer, a dancer, and an instrument representing this Trinity.
That's all that was on stage, those three people?
For each character.
Oh, okay. What was it again? What were the three parts?
One was an instrument, one was a dancer, and one was an opera singer.
Okay.
But
instrument.
These three things were representing one person.
Right.
So he was talking about these ideas, but it's like...
multiple forms.
Yeah, all these... his mysticism, which was really complex. And
when he talked to you... he talked in German and you could understand it.
Yes.
That's pretty good. When Lillian called yesterday, were you guys talking Spanish?
Yeah.
Yeah. What did she say? what about Mexico winning? Was she all excited? What did you have to say to her?
Because she was not able to see the football game. She was asking me how it was.
And did you know?
Well, more or less.
So you described it. Yeah, so that's just a digression. I overheard the conversation. That was one of what never would
remember. Because Umberto was, like, reporting.
Yeah. Okay, so you're there, and what happened after the performance? Did you keep talking to him? Did you see him again? Or did he go back to where he lived?
Well, I remember, because I'm always very confused with dates.
Yeah.
But I think it was after that there was this 9/11.
Yeah, that's 2001. Scandal. And he made a very controversial statement about it.
Yes, but I remember when I saw the planes, these holograms, or whatever they were, crashing into these buildings, I had earphones. And I was watching the TV with earphones.
Yeah.
Because my husband was a pianist and he was playing. So I had earphones as I was watching the TV, and they showed this thing with the planes crashing into the buildings. And I remember thinking, the sound is so amazing.
Right.
And then I heard that he said that it was the most amazing concert.
Yes.
But unfortunately, like, the audience was not aware that this, because, and he said the impact of what they achieved goes beyond the impact of whatever composer could ever achieve.
Any composer, he said.
But he was like saying, yeah, it took many people into their death, but...
as a musical experiment, it was the greatest concert ever.
Yes, so, but he was so into his own abstraction, and for him, because he was a Christian, it was not such a tragedy. He believes in heaven, so...
Yeah, that people survive death.
Yeah, they will transition into paradise or something. But, of course, for everybody, it was like is he stupid, crazy, or what? Like, it's like the statements made by Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah.
That they're taking out of context and...
So his reputation suffered from that point on?
Not really, because he's such a... I mean, he's the pioneer. The pioneer of electronic music.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean...
Have you ever seen the footage? I think it's on YouTube or seen some Zappa movie of Zappa visiting him. You ever seen that?
No.
Yeah, we got to get that for you. Yeah, he visited I'm pretty sure it's Stockhausen. And they talk about some weird German folk figure. Folk elf or imp, like a little Rumpelstiltskin. I think that's what they talk about. Which is what Zappa said he was, Rumpelstiltskin. So it's relevant that they talked about that figure. I have to look it up. Okay, so back to...
I could get what he was trying to express. Like,
because you thought the sound was amazing, too.
Yes, and I know that he has all these mystical ideas, so... For him, I don't know, whatever he thinks the transcendence of humans go beyond this plane. So he could not see that as a...
As a tragedy.
Well, as the end.
Right. Well, that's what... I didn't know he had said that till you told me. Few years later, but I said later that day, I was telling people, this is the greatest art form ever. This is the greatest performance. I was saying that.
Yes, because it really changed the whole environment, everything.
Right. And you know, when I talked to McLuhan through another lady, a medium, she's the one who drove us up to the border. Her husband created Canada's CIA, known as CSIS, a famous Toronto family. They have a cultural center named after her, and or after her family. But so within a couple of days, we're there after 911. We go up the following Saturday, and Carolyn spends 3 weeks there. I spend 3 weeks at Nelson Falls, but we would go down to Esteraco's place and hang out with her and Carolyn. And so suddenly she had to start to go into trance because she had been a psychic in the 70s and had actually been studied by J.B. Rhine at Duke University, who was the famous, one of the first official psychic researchers in a university context. So she had separated from her husband and spent many years down there being studied as a psychic. But then she stopped doing it. And then 30 years later, all of a sudden she has the desire to do it. So she goes into trance, and Pierre Trudeau comes through, and she created Trudeau's political career. She was very influential in the Liberal Party. And then McLuhan came through, and McLuhan said, anybody who knew media and the history of media could have predicted that. He said, it's totally logical that that happened and that it came that way. So... I don't know anybody else who's got McLuhan's opinion on 911. I've got it.
Well, we made a video in which I see the S of the Solomon Temple.
Yes.
It's like the S and the T, and then this symbol of the snake ascending. And then you have the two columns, the two towers.
Yeah, yeah.
With the S, that is the 9/11.
Yeah.
So there, an ion is explaining us that that was a portal.
Right.
And that the materials came from a parallel world.
The hologram, it was a hologram that was removed. It was taken back to the world it came from. And then we hallucinated or something was created where we thought a building was collapsing. But so
yes,
so the dust
this
cloud...
This happens in the Big Apple.
Yeah, in
so
the Big Apple.
So you have the symbol of the snake in the paradise, the snake in the tree
yeah,
of life.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well, what's the S? Is the S the building?
The S is the snake.
Yeah, but where's the snake in the Twin Towers?
Well, it's the September 11th.
Oh, you mean the letter S is all over it?
Yes, it's something weird that somehow gives me this, like, visuals, and I just know what they mean.
Right. So 911 is S and the two towers.
Yes, and it also relates to the symbol of the cross and the snake.
Yeah.
The snake, that's the thing Moses will carry. And the people who will see that symbol will get healed.
Right, the snake around the staff.
Yes, and then the snake was replaced by Jesus.
Right.
But this is these things actually are like alchemical symbols about ascension, about the chromosome 14, about... We did some videos in
right
where we explained those.
We talked about that in 911. So Stockhausen, have you read his alchemy? Does he talk about alchemy?
No, I haven't read his
whatever he's done.
No, I like the music, but I wasn't turned on by his mystical ideas.
Right, and another point you told me is that he was quite distracted. He may have even been stoned when he was giving his lecture. He kept looking up at the ceiling.
Well, I think he thinks in such an abstract level that maybe like you, for him it's so evident that he's just like into his own abstraction, into his own ideas.
Almost autistic. The modern phrase, autistic. He was very absorbed, almost selfishly, in his own ideas.
Yeah, like...
Okay, so that...
Like, I think it's the most passionate person I've seen. Like, he has this Picasso intensity. Like,
yeah.
Like, they don't stop. They're like artists 24-7.
Yeah.
Like...
Well, that's me. I do that 24/7.
Yeah, they're always on duty. They don't take a break. They're all the time thinking and creating. It's
Are you like that?
No, I think these are like major geniuses.
Oh, you don't you think a lot, but you don't do it 24/7.
Not like that. I think they never turn off. Like, that was my impression.
Right, and Zappa was much like that too.
Yes, like they're workaholics and they're just into that.
Yeah. Okay, so that you had known of him since you were young, so that was a nice encounter in your life to meet your mentor, your guru, your inspiration. So was there anybody else? Was Pierre Schaeffer an inspiration?
Yes, but he's more like a theoretician. Of electroacoustic music.
Theoretician, yeah.
And I don't like his music as much as Stockhausen's. Like,
right. You've listened to Penderecki, Webern,
yes.
Everybody. All the people that Zappa lists on his album, you've heard all those albums from very early age, right?
Yes, and many come to Berlin, and I had the chance to even see them in the concerts.
So you were in the right place to continue your career, since Mexico was a problem for women, too limiting, and so Berlin was the perfect place because it was a cultural center in Europe.
Yeah, for me it's the best place to be.
Right. So So then you meet me and Ion, and we introduce you to McLuhan, which is a big discovery for you that you had not any familiarity with what he had really written about, and you were quite taken by it. But one interesting experience was Derek de Kerckhoff arranged a televised dialogue between McLuhan and Pierre Schaeffer. So here you were seeing your teacher sort of act ridiculous with McLuhan. That was a big ending point of your education or peak experience, right?
Yes, I really like Marshall McLuhan because Pierre Schaeffer is like saying we are mystics and Marshall McLuhan is just laughing like I'm not a mystic. Like, do you know the meaning of the word? Like,
yeah, he kept correcting Schaeffer.
Yes, I really like Marshall McLuhan because he was a real mystic, but
he kept
that to himself. He wasn't making a show.
Yeah.
Out of that, and I think for me it was very impressive when Antonio Rusek explained to me the ray of creation and the harmonies and all these things, the Gurdjieff system
from
Gurdjieff,
yeah,
are very, very, very complex. And Antonio Rusek is an engineer, and he's not like a weird new age person. He was like very coherent and intelligent, and the complexity of all these things and the concepts of like the objective art and all this, for me as a child was like, wow, this, you can understand the universe with physics and acoustics and harmonies,
right?
But for me, it was very impressive to see an engineer to go into sort of mystical topics.
Yeah.
And somebody who can understand how to build a synthesizer. And because it's not the same to talk about these things with somebody who is just spiritual and with somebody who has this type of moral technical scientific knowledge.
Yeah, like a craftsman.
Yes, like my grandfather, he had a big culture, but he will go into all these mystery landscape topics. But for me, it was very impressive that he could also go into science and
who, your grandfather?
No, Antonio Rusek.
Your grandfather didn't do the science as much.
No.
Yeah.
But then Stockhausen, in a way,
was doing that too.
Yes, like these people are really thinking and what I like about Ion, because when I, like, my goal was to be a nun and develop my spiritual gifts.
Right.
And then one day my father said, okay, you really want to be a nun? Yes. And why would you like to be a nun? And I said, because I want to develop my spiritual gifts. And he looked at me like with a smirk, like, well, you have to know this is very hard. Not everybody can do it. It's only a very few that become like saints and can do that. And like, he was trying to tell me just do something else. Like, but I was so disappointed, like, of course I can. But
did he discourage you? Did you believe his discouragement?
Well, in a way, yes. Like,
yeah.
Like.
And that's when you were 14.
Yeah, like they told me, look, in the convent, it's not what you expect or what you think it is. And
but you went anyways. And then he turned out to be partly right because it wasn't what you thought it would be. It was not a school.
So, when I learned, like, they show this film, the meetings with the...
Yeah, by Peter Watkins, or Meetings with a Remarkable Man.
Yes, and you see these people going into these types of...
Dancing.
Schools,
yeah.
Where they develop all these amazing capabilities, and they do these very weird, complex dances, and they're just, like, completely into developing to their full capabilities.
Yeah, and it's an aesthetic level.
All the apps that we have, like I always say, all the apps that we have and we don't know we have, and then like there. So when I was listening to Ian, and he will talk about these things like you can do it.
Yeah.
I was like, wait a minute, and you were talking about economy and politics and technologies, Marshall McLuhan and James Joyce, and in an intelligent, coherent way, not like a cult or like a New Age,
Coop.
Crazy, whatever.
Yeah.
So that I think was like the right next step to take.
Yeah. When you saw Meetings with Remarkable Men, were you? Was that before you went to the convent?
No, that was after.
Right. But it showed you what you thought would be at a convent, and was
it? Yes, like that was what I wanted, but
yeah.
It's not.
Right. Yeah,
but,
it's...
Yes, I read about some nuns which are not, like, into the church.
Right.
I think in California. And they make products out of marijuana.
Yeah.
For healing. But they live like in a community, and I thought, oh, that's a cool way to do it. Like maybe start your own community, and you have your gardens, your education, wherever you study, you create, and they have something to live from. Like they make these healing products from marijuana.
Now, you read about that before you were 14?
No, I just read about them.
Oh, recently.
Yeah, so maybe that was, I thought it was.
Right, right. So when, in 94, before you went to Berlin, 93, 94, you teamed up with an anthropologist and lived with this, jungle people. Was that an idea? Was that after you went to the convent? Yeah, it probably was.
Yes, well, first, I wanted to go out of Mexico City, and my father was in Yucatan. So I went there, and when I was there, I met an anthropologist. She was doing some research on Maya embroideries. And... we were talking, and she said, oh, I need somebody like you because you're a designer to document all these Maya techniques of embroideries because they might get lost. Most of the young people want to go work in these hotels, and they don't want to wear their traditional clothing.
Yeah.
And so I was doing this research, and I thought... Like a nun, like, I'm going to help these people. I'm going to teach them something. And it was actually all the way around.
Yeah. So you had, that didn't work out, being with them. So then that's when you went to Berlin. But so it wasn't like another way of forming a community, being an anthropologist. That wasn't your motive. Just you were given an opportunity to help this person, so you did it. So you had this image of a real convent all through the years, and then you see Peter Watkins, I think that's his name, movie, and shows you the way the convent could be with the people whirling and dancing, you know, with the cloths hanging from the ceiling. I remember those scenes. But you saw Stockhausen. You're part of the community. You make compositions. You go into... other people's concerts, but it's so tiny.